detail. It's not where we just get on a sermon and preach, but really trying to teach and connect the dots to kind of give a flow to the story, the history of the Bible. And now we have come to Exodus. Joseph, of course, was sold into as a slave and rose to greatness within Egypt. And now his father and family have joined him there. His father has died, Jacob. And now at the end of Genesis, Joseph has died. We have a 300-year span of really nothing. We know that they went there and they prospered. In fact, Exodus begins by telling us that they prospered. In verse number 7, the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly and multiplied and waxed exceeding mighty. And the land was filled with them. Recall that they went to Goshen, and that was the area where they settled because they wanted to be segregated from the Egyptians. They wanted to keep their culture. They wanted to keep their faith. They wanted to keep their customs, and they wanted to keep their bloodline pure. And I know that those are things that are frowned upon these days and by this society, but that's always been the intention of God with the Jews, always been the intention. And so we see how they maintained a certain segregation and separated themselves in Goshen. But in that land, by the way, they said we're cattlemen, we're shepherds. And the Egyptians didn't want anything to do with that kind of people. They didn't want to deal with them. And so they grew and they multiplied and they were fruitful and they were prosperous. And they just made a community of it. They succeeded. They were successful. Remember, these are the people out of whom came Joseph, who saved really the world, at least to their knowledge. But then we find verse 8, it says, there rose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. And I couldn't help but think of it as I was studying this about what's going on in our country today. You know, they're taking down monuments and statues, and they're just concrete statues. It doesn't change history. But they've forgotten. You know, Robert E. Lee, though they always recognize him, and he's well known as a Confederate, he was much more than a Confederate general. He was so much more of a man. But we find these narrow ideas and reasons that we should erase them from history, and we change the schools' names because, oh, that guy owned slaves. And I got news for you. You're not going to find anybody pure in all the history of the world. We'll be able to find anybody who's got a statue anywhere and say, well, he did something wrong, so get rid of it. And all we do by doing that is show that we are ignorant of the value of a man beyond his flaws. We're ignorant of the value of people and what they contributed. That's why the statue's there, for what they contributed to society. And not only that, but we forget the people who put them there. You know what the Bible says? Not to remove the ancient landmarks. You know, before you take down a fence, determine why it was put up. It's so important. It's an old rule, an old cliche, but we ought to always think about why was that put there before we take something down. And so here we see there rose up a king that didn't know Joseph. And so because he didn't know Joseph, he had no honor, no appreciation, no respect for that man. The regard for Joseph was lost. History was lost. Remember, as we looked this morning at Belshazzar, Daniel's accusation against him and his condemnation against him was, you knew what happened, but you disregarded it. You didn't humble your heart even though you knew these things to be true. And that's what we find here. Egypt went through a terrible drought, a dearth, a famine. And had it not been for this man Joseph, under the guidance of God's hand, Egypt would have been destroyed. All the region would have been destroyed. But because God raised up Joseph, they were saved. In verse number 9, he said to the people, this Pharaoh, this king who knew not Joseph, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Now, you're all familiar with the term exaggeration, right? How many of you ever made a mountain out of a molehill? Right? We exaggerate. and we see a small problem and we make it out to be a gigantic problem, a huge issue, and we choke on gnats and swallow camels, as Jesus said in the New Testament. And that's the reality. We take these small things and we make them major issues. And here this king exaggerated his fear. It was what we call today propaganda. All he was trying to do is turn the Egyptians against the Jews because of his anxiety, because of his fears. In verse number 10, "Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply, and it come to pass when there falleth out any war, they join unto our enemies and fight against us. So get them up out of the land." And we see now that the strategy, the goal, was to run them off. The goal was to get them out of Egypt. That was the intention. And so what they did is they gave them work. They required them. They demanded of them to do work. But here's what happened. As the Jews were doing the work, they found out, hey, these guys are really good at this. These guys do good work. They work well as a team. And so as they were building the cities for Egypt and communities, buildings, monuments. They were doing all this great work. And they said, what would happen now if we got rid of these guys? The goal was to get rid of them. And you know what the Jews did? Rather than say, well, if that's the way you're going to be, I'm going to leave. They just adjusted. They just adapted to the work, and they worked harder, and they got stronger. In verse number 12, the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And the Egyptians were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the work increased, and the work improved. And so they said, well, let's give them more work. And so they made the work harder. It says they made them serve with rigor. They made their lives miserable. But see, the Jews didn't just up and leave. Why? Because they were with their people. Because that was their home. Those were their people. And so they just adapted and they just did the work and they just got the job done. Harsh labor. We find in verses 15 through 16 that a genocide was ordered. That all of the males would be killed. They would not be delivered. As soon as that child would be born, that he would be killed. If it was a boy, if it was a girl, keep him. Why? Boy, I tell you, we keep running into politics here. The feminization of the nation. They wanted to feminize. They wanted to strip the nation of its masculinity. The identity of the Jews, if we could take away the masculinity, we could take away the identity. We'd make the women would marry Egyptians. Why? Because they were the only men that would be left, right? And so they would just blend into the Egyptian culture, and this Hebrew culture, this Jewish culture, would be a thing of the past. And so keep the girls, kill the boys. But the midwives said, that's not right. We can't do that. That would be dishonorable. That would be wrong. And so they refused to kill the boys that were born. And so when the king realized that he didn't get the midwives to do his work, he just made an order for all of the people. If you find the little Jewish boy, you throw him in the river. That was his plan. Let the crocodiles eat him. That was his idea. To kill the boys who were born to the Jews. Now in chapter 2, verses 1 through 10, we find the introduction of Moses. There went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw him that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. When she could not longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrush, daubed it with slime and pitch, put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. His sister stood afar off to wit what would be done to him, and the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river. And her maidens walked along by the river's side, and when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. She had compassion on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away. Nurse it for me. I'll give thee thy wages." And the woman took the child and nursed it. Isn't that incredible? I mean, God is just amazing the way He worked it all out. It was all planned out. God was saving this man for greatness. He had a purpose for this child. And so, it all worked. I mean, she's going to get paid to raise her own kid. And it all just, it worked out perfectly. But under the protection, and this is the key, under the protection of the Pharaoh. He'd be protected as one of Pharaoh's own grandchildren. And so God had it all worked out. Now, as we go on down in verse number 11 of chapter 2, it came to pass in those days when Moses was grown that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens, and spied an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, one of his brethren. He looked this way and that way, and when he saw that there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. So Moses was interested, though he may have been raised under the Egyptian philosophies, he was taught by his mother the Hebrew traditions and faith. And he saw a Hebrew being mistreated, and he killed the Egyptian thug that was mistreating the Hebrew. And then he buried him in the sand right there. And he probably didn't feel good about it. But he didn't think anybody would know about it. He thought he had hidden his sin. How many of you ever thought you had hidden your sin? All right? You can't hide your sin. You know, the Bible says your sin will find you out. It'll discover you. And so the next day, and this is what's important, the next day, in verse 13, he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together. Now there's no Egyptian involved in this, but two Jews. And he said to them that did the wrong, "Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow?" And he said, "Who made thee a prince and judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killest the Egyptian?" And Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." Now in Pharaoh, verse 15, when Pharaoh heard this, he sought to slay Moses. So we get the idea that Pharaoh was not a fan. He was not a big fan of Moses. And Moses then, realizing that his secret was known, escaped and ran away to another land. Now he ran a long way. He didn't try to hide in town. He got out of there. And verse 16, now the priest of Midian had seven daughters. They came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. So Moses is always there to help the underdog, to help the mistreated. He really felt that he had this composure, this presence. We get the idea he had this presence with people. And he didn't just wait back and let people be taken advantage of. He didn't just stand back and watch people be hurt. He got involved. And Moses helped these female shepherds when the shepherds were trying not to let them get water. He helped them. And he was invited into their home. They went home and told their. They went home with the flock, and their dad says, "What are y'all doing home so early?" They said, "Oh yeah, well, this guy was up there. This Egyptian had this Egyptian clothing on, Egyptian jewelry on, and he helped us get water. The shepherds were trying to run us off and make us wait, and he stood up to them." And Jethro said, "Well, where is the young man? Go get him and invite him to the house. Let's feed him." And that's what happened. So Moses then is introduced into Jethro's home to the priest of Midian, the seven daughters. And we go on down to verse number 21. Moses was content to dwell with the man. And he gave Moses Zipporah, his daughter. Now I have an idea that having seven daughters helped convince Moses to be content to dwell there. Don't you? I mean, here's a young single man far away from home. And comes to this house, it's got seven daughters. Now, it doesn't say she was as beautiful as Rachel, right? Or as ugly as Leah. But it just says that there were seven daughters there. And Joseph goes and he's invited into the home. And again, you know, these are the little points in Moses' story, but they make a world of difference. Do you realize, and you sit back sometime and just think about the pivot points in your life where somebody just said the right thing, you were just in the right place, you just found the right opportunity, and life changed. Man, life changed. And I can see people sometimes, I show you this, I wish there was a chart where I could watch people's lives according to their decisions and how it improves and how it declined. Because I've seen people, and there's a single point. There was one thing that you did that ruined your life. You say, how can that be? Because I've watched it happen over and over again. Just one try, just one attempt, just one thing, just said one thing. Look at the people in the politics and government, and they say one thing. You say, well, but that's accumulation of their attitude and their arrogance. Yeah, but they still were getting away with it till they said that one thing. Or till they did that one thing. And I'm telling you, every moment is just that important. And in just one moment, we can either gain it all or lose it all. And that's what we're seeing throughout the Scriptures, whether it's Jacob or whether it's Abraham or whether it's Joseph or whether it's... who are we talking about now? Moses? Yeah, whoever it is, every step of the way, what we find is these pivotal moments. And these very pivotal moments, and maybe you say, well, if it hadn't been for so-and-so, I never would have even been interested in that line of work, but because they recommended it, I got into it and it changed my life. If it hadn't been for so-and-so inviting me, I never would have found that church, and I never would have found Jesus. And I'll tell you something, you talk about a pivotal moment, when you found Jesus, that was pivotal. Now, it can be that life-changing event. But you know, for a lot of people, it's just another day. It changes their eternity, but they never take it seriously enough to let God change their lives. So please do. Let God change your life. Well, so Moses is satisfied to stay with Jethro. And he marries Zipporah in verse 21. Verse 22, she bare him a son and called his name Gershom. He said, I've been a stranger in a strange land. It came to pass in the process of time. By the way, if you understand, I don't know if you looked at a map, but if you understand where we are, we're about midpoint. We're from Egypt to Canaan. We're right in between there. He's working in this land where he will eventually be called and commissioned to lead God's people through that very same land. He knew the hills. He knew the mountains. He knew the prairies. He knew the valleys. Why? Because that's where he was a shepherd. It wasn't an accident that God sent those seven girls to the water at that time. And Moses said, I better look into this. You see, God worked it all out. He was moving all the pieces in place, putting the puzzle all together. And you say, but I've been praying for God to work it out. Do you understand all the people in the world and how many of them have to be shifted and adjusted and persuaded in order for God to answer one prayer that you've got? It's a chess game. It's complicated. It's a huge puzzle. And yet when we reach out and pray, God begins to put things in motion and move things around. Because He's answering that prayer on our heart. Not one of us is in this by ourselves. A lot of people connected to our prayers and to our acts. Verse 23, it came to pass in the process of time, the king of Egypt died. The children of Israel sighed by reason of their bondage. They cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groanings. And God remembered His covenant with Abraham. Didn't we see something similar to that this morning? Where God said to Hezekiah, you have wronged me. You have abused the opportunities. And I've allowed Assyria to come in here and sweep through Judah and destroy and conquer and seize every town. I'm going to save Jerusalem for my servant David's sake. That's it. For David's sake. And here, as he hears these people crying up from Egypt, It wasn't that they had earned a right to pray. It wasn't that they deserved mercy. It wasn't that they ever had a thought in their mind to surrender to God and let God have His way in their lives. God said, I remember the covenant I have with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God remembered those men. God remembered His promise to those men. And God looked, verse 25, looked upon the children of Israel. And God had respect unto them. Now in chapter 3 we pick up and we do learn about Moses keeping the flock for Jethro, the priest in Midian, on the backside of the desert. And he came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. And the angel of the Lord appeared unto him in a flame of fire in the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush burned with fire, and the bush was not consumed. Again, the appearance of God. I just want to draw you into this. And I don't want to stretch it out, but you ever see people sit around a campfire and just stare into the fire? And it doesn't change. But you know why we're drawn to that? Because it somehow, subconsciously, spiritually, connects us or reminds us of God. Because that's what God looks like. That energy, that flash, that like lightning, like fire. When God reached down and picked up Elijah and took him to heaven, it was we call it a chariot of fire. But it was really like God reaching down His hand and picking Elijah up and taking him home. That's why we're drawn to that appearance. That's why when we go to a concert, or a lot of churches now have these displays and they have all these flashing lights. You look in the book of Ezekiel, and that's how Ezekiel described God when he saw Him. That energy, smoke, the essence. We go into later on as Moses goes and tries to walk into the tabernacle. The air is so thick with God's presence that he can't enter in. The essence of God. He sees a burning bush, what's called a burning bush, looks like a burning bush. In the midst of a bush, the bush burned, but the bush was not consumed. Verse 3, Moses said, I'll now turn aside and see this great sight. Why the bush is not burnt? You see, because if a bush was so hot and dry that it was to spontaneously combust, it would burn up. But this one didn't. Why? Because it wasn't fire, it was the energy of God. When the Lord saw, verse 4, that he had turned aside to see, God called him out of the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here am I. He said, draw not nigh hither. Put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground. This mountain, Horeb, the mountain of God. Moreover, he said in verse 6, I am the God of thy father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters. I know their sorrows. I'm come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up out of the land unto a good land, a large land, unto a land flowing with milk and honey. To the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, Amorites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Now therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come unto me. I have also seen the oppression wherewith the Egyptians oppressed them. So God in this now sends Moses in verse 10, come now therefore, and I will send thee to Pharaoh. And that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt. And he said, certainly I will be with thee. And this shall be. And I like verse 12. This is important. This is one of those pivotal moments. This shall be a token to thee that I have sent thee. When thou hast brought forth the people out of Egypt, ye shall serve God upon this mountain. You're going to come back here to this very place. I don't know about you, but I like to go places where I feel good. How many of y'all like to go places where you feel good? How many of y'all like going to the hospital? You know why? Because when we go to the hospital, we don't feel good, either emotionally or physically. But for whatever reason we go to the hospital, it does not make us happy to be there. But when we go to a restaurant and we feel good about it, what do? We keep going back to that restaurant. If we have friends or family and we enjoy going to their house, what do? We keep going back. If we find a church that we walk in the door and we feel the presence of God and we want to be there and we enjoy being there, what do? We go back. That's natural. And I imagine from the moment that Moses left on this journey, he could not wait to get back to that mountain. I imagine there were times in the journey where all he could think about is, when I get back to that mountain, I'm going to talk to God again. I'm going to be back in that place and see God again. Yes, he talks with God. He deals with God in Egypt. But there was something special about this place. It's so important for us. And I appreciate all of the efforts and all of the things, even testimonies that have been given tonight. But it's so important for us. Guys, I know that we come here because of what we need. But when people come here that have not already caught the vision and have not already gained the insight into what God is doing and what God can do, we have got to make them feel good about being here. We can't make them feel unwelcome. We can't make them feel unappreciated. We've got to make them feel like we're glad they're here. And you know, we ought to do that for the members too, right? We've got to make everybody feel glad that they've been here and that they were appreciated. But especially for visitors. Because we already understand, we come because we know what God has to offer. We enjoy coming. We feel good when we come here. That's why we keep coming back. That's why it's so easy to come back. But we come for the Word of God. We come to praise and we come to worship and we come to pray and we come to share. There's a lot of different reasons. There's something special about the way we make people feel. We've got to learn to make people feel good around us. So they'll want to be around us. Well, he says, you'll serve on this mountain and that'll be proof. That'll be the token. Verse 13, Moses said to God, behold, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is God's name? What shall I say unto them? Verse 14, and God said unto Moses, I am that I am. Thus shalt thou say unto the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. The very essence of being, the very existence of all things, I am. God said moreover to Moses, verse 15, thus shalt thou say to the children of Israel, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial unto all generations. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say unto them, the Lord God of your fathers, the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, has appeared unto me, saying, I have surely visited you and seen that which is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I will bring you up. So in these verses, in verse 15 through 18, God says to Moses, first take this message to the people. I'm going to set you free. Pharaoh has to release you. But first you go to the people and convince them. First you go tell them. You got to give them the message. And it goes back, remember, to Sunday school this morning, where the Assyrian army, Sennacherib, came in there. Sennacherib's messenger came in and said messengers that came out from the city, and they said, well, talk to us in your tongue because we understand it. And he said, we didn't come to talk to you anyway. We come to talk to the people that are on the wall. We came to talk to the voters and the population. We don't care anything about the politicians. And we come with our message and we're going to speak it in Hebrew because they understand that. And here, again, God says, you go to the people. You go to the people and you tell them. I'm going to tell you something. We worry so much about changing government. What we need to learn is that the focus should be on the people, not on the government. You know, the corruption is deep and wide, but we have got to focus on changing the hearts of men. The statistics I read this morning about the conditions of America and the immorality, the crime, that's a reflection of sin. in the heart of man. We got to reach people. We're so worried about what goes on in Washington, D.C., and we can't change it by just whining about it. We change it by making a difference in the hearts of people. He says, go to the people. Go to the people. Verse 19, God says, I'm sure the king of Egypt will not let you go. No, not by a mighty hand. Now look, I got a great big job for you, and I want you to know when you get there, you can't do it. I want you to know when you get there, there's going to be huge obstacles in the way. He's not trying to sell him something that's not true. He's telling him everything right up front, above board. And he says in verse 20, but I will stretch out my hand and smite Egypt with my wonders, which I will do in the midst thereof. And after that, he will let you go. As we go back, remember how we started this. We got to get rid of these Hebrews. We got to run them out of the land. But as they gave them tasks and they gave them assignments, they found out they're pretty good workers. They do a good job. And so they locked them in, and now the fight is that they don't want to let them go. Sometimes we lose our argument in our arguing, don't we? Anybody ever done that? Sometimes we're so caught up in winning, and that's what it's about a lot of the times. It's not about right and wrong. It's about winning the argument. That's what a debate is. A lot of times we don't just have a discussion. I run into this everywhere. Do y'all ever run into this around? People don't want to have a discussion. They want to have a debate. And they want to win the debate. The problem is sometimes in the debate we lose our argument. In arguing we forget where we started. Have y'all ever watched the cartoons? Like Bugs Bunny and all those kind of guys, and maybe even the Three Stooges. I mean, that's classic. Y'all all ought to know that, right? Where they start and say, no, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. No, I'm not. Yes, you are. Yes, I am. No, you're not. Okay. And isn't that how it sometimes works? We're so caught up in being obstinate and debating that we forget what the argument was. God has aligned and worked out and organized Moses to be a great leader. What's the difference in you and Moses? Yeah, there's some historical differences. But the truth is, God's got purpose for all of us. We were born on purpose, with purpose, designed and created to do God's work. The key is, and remember, 40 years he was just in Egypt doing nothing. How many of you feel like you wasted 40 years? 40 years he never... How many of you look at your kids and say, when are they going to finally grow up? Find a purpose. When are they going to finally figure out what life is all about? Well, at 40 years old, Moses identified with the people of God. For 40 years, what did he do? He kept sheep. Learned how to be a husband, a son-in-law, and a shepherd. Really? I mean, he was walking in all that place. He didn't know he was being prepared. He didn't know he was learning the trade that God had him designed for. And now, finally, after 80 years that we would say, well, it's all been wasted, it wasn't. It was building up to something. He was working his way to something. Now, that doesn't give us an excuse to wait till we're 80 to do anything. But understand that everything plays together and works together. What does Romans 8:28 say? All things work together for the good. Those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose. So it all can work together. The mistakes, the corrections, the good, the bad. Just let God use it all to work out. Finally, God says, I want you to tell the Hebrews this. He said, you tell them when they leave, they won't leave empty. Remember when Jacob came, Pharaoh said, you tell them leave all their clothes at home and just get in the truck and come on. And when they get here, we'll give them everything they need. Isn't that what he said? And they got there and they came pretty much empty. But he said, you tell them they won't be leaving empty. First of all, he said, you tell all those women to go and borrow all the stuff they can from their neighbors. Gold, jewelry, whatever. Just get it all. He said, because when y'all leave, you're taking it all with you. We're taking it as a spoil, as conquerors. God has a plan. We've just got to trust Him and hang in there and let Him work it out. Let's stand.